Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and on the following half hour, we're going to be taking a look at W, as a columnist Molly Ivins calls him. That's George W. Bush, the current front runner in the race to gain the Republican nomination for president. Some very unappetizing aspects of George W.'s political agenda were revealed in the San Francisco Examiner of Friday, November 26th of 1999, in a column by syndicated columnist Carl T. Rowan. This is Dateline Washington and headlined by the Examiner. It is becoming clear that Texas Governor George W. Bush will give us, if he is elected, what Texas Governor George W. Bush will give us if he is elected president, as now seems probable. The most conservative, in my view, frightening U.S. Supreme Court in this century. A strident foreign policy that will regenerate the Cold War with both Russia and China. We're going to touch on the foreign policy aspect in a minute. A period of unimaginable strife over abortion rights. Bush made this clear Sunday during an interview on NBC's Meet the Press when he said some things that showed him to be far to the right of what a lot of Americans have assumed him to be. When NBC's Tim Russert asked, "Which Supreme Court justice do you really respect?" Bush replied, "Anthony Scalia is one." He added, "Judge Clarence Thomas, I think he got a raw shake during the nomination process," unquote. Asked if he would make opposition to abortion a litmus test for any person he appointed to the highest court, Bush said he would want to know if his nominee would give a strict interpretation, unquote, of the Constitution. Scalia and Thomas are the two most reactionary members of the court, and Bush is citing them as models of what he would appoint strikes fear in my heart, and surely in the hearts of millions of other Americans. Skipping down, I am certain that Bush also lost a lot of liberals and moderates when he said that as president, he will support a constitutional amendment to ban all abortions, except in the case of incest and rape, or when a woman's life is endangered. He also said basically he's going to kick a blank blank with regard to Russia and China if they don't come around to his way of looking at things. In the past, on the subject of George W.'s political heritage, we've taken a look at the fact that he flies around in a plane that was owned by Barry Seal, one of the principal players in the Iran-Contra affair and a drug smuggler of considerable note. 08 Foxtrot, one of the aircraft that was used by Barry Seal in the Iran-Contra affair, is now one of George Bush's favorite planes as he flies about on Texas state aircraft. In For the Record segment 182, and that, by the way, was discussed in 181, in For the Record segment 182, we took a look at some business connections between George W. and his Arbusto Energy Company and the family of Saudi terrorist Osama bin Laden, the best known of the Wahhabi fighters currently making their presence felt around the world, including in former parts of the Soviet Union, or parts of the former Soviet Union. We're going to review some of the aspects of the George Bush bin Laden connection and add some supplemental material. We're going to take a look at a suppressed biography of George Bush. This is entitled Fortunate Son, subtitled George W. Bush and the Making of an American President. This was authored by J.H. Hatfield, published in hardcover by St. Martin's Press, copyright 1999. Actually, it was copyright 2000 by Omega Publishing, although it came out in 1999. And this book was suppressed and recalled after it came out that J.H. Hatfield had a criminal record. Of the connection between the bin Laden family and George W. Bush through his Arbusto Energy Company, we read as follows in Fortunate Son. Speaking of Bush, J.H. Hatfield writes, in June 1977, he formed his own drilling company, Arbusto Energy. Arbusto means Bush in Spanish. Like his father, who made his fortune in the oil business with the money of others, George W. founded Arbusto with the financial backing of investors including James R. Baff, a Houston businessman whom Bush apparently first met when they were in the same Texas Air National Guard unit. Tax documents and personal financial records show that Baff, an aircraft broker with business ties to Saudi Arabian sheiks, had invested $50,000 in Arbusto, granting him a 5% interest in two limited partnerships controlled by Bush. In one of the most bizarre footnotes to history, Time magazine described Bath in 1991 as, quote, a deal broker whose alleged associations run from the CIA to a major shareholder and director of the Bank of Credit and Commerce, unquote. BCCI, as it was more commonly known, was closed down in July of 1991 amid charges of multi-billion dollar fraud and worldwide news reports that the institution had been involved in covert intelligence work, drug money laundering, arms brokering, bribery of government officials, and aid to terrorists. An accounting commission by the Bank of England finally exposed the extent of BCCI's deficits and criminal offenses, forcing the bank's eventual collapse. Bath was never directly implicated in the BCCI scandal, but according to the Outlaw Bank, an award-winning 1993 book by Time correspondents Jonathan Beatty and S.C. Gwynne, Bath originally, quote, made his fortune by investing money for Sheikh Khalid bin Mahfouz and another BCCI-connected Saudi, Sheikh bin Laden, unquote. Allegedly the father of none other than Osama bin Laden, the man accused by the U.S. government of masterminding the August 1998 terrorist bombings of the American embassy in Kenya and Tanzania, which killed more than 250 people. According to news reports, in a 1976 trust agreement drawn shortly after Bush's father was appointed director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Saudi Sheikh Salim M. bin Laden appointed Bath as his business representative in Texas. Bin Laden, along with his brothers, owned Bin Laden Brothers Construction, one of the largest construction companies in the Middle East. In a 1991 deposition, Bath testified he was the sole director of Skyway Aircraft Leasing Limited, a Houston company owned by Khaled bin Mahfouz. Bin Mahfouz had been a major shareholder in BCCI, which had been accused of using Mideast oil money to seek ties to political leaders in other countries throughout the 1970s and 1980s. By the way, I would note that Oliver North used BCCI for many of his Iran-Contra machinations. Time reporters Beatty and Gwynne suggest in their book that the $50,000 Bath invested in George W.'s Arbusto Energy Drilling Company may have belonged to Bath's Saudi clients, since the Houston businessman, quote, had no substantial money of his own at the time, unquote. Ironically, the money used to underwrite the first business venture of a possible future president of the United States may have been derived, at least in part, from the family fortune of Saudi terrorist Osama bin Laden. According to court documents, Bath also swore that in 1977 he represented four prominent and wealthy Saudi Arabians as a trustee and used his name on their investments in the United States. In return, he received a 5% interest in their deals. Federal authorities, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, and the FBI later investigated Bath after allegations were made by one of his American business partners that the Saudis were using Bath and their enormous financial sources to influence U.S. policy. And skipping down, in 1990, in an attempt to distance himself and his presidential father from the growing BCCI scandal, George W. stated in an interview that neither he nor the elder Bush had ever conducted business with James Bath. Junior went on record at the time as saying that he met the Houston businessman in 1970 when both were fighter pilots at the Air National Guard base at Ellington. President Bush, quote, knows Bath the way he knows thousands of people, unquote, his son told the press, and the two men could not be considered good friends. Quote, I've never done business with him, Bath, and I don't know, and I know the president hasn't either, unquote. Well, at least in the case of George W., he was lying. He obviously had been doing business with him. He was a Bath owned 5% in two limited partnerships controlled by Bush. Note again that, as written here by J.H. Hadfield, Saudi Sheikh Salim M. bin Laden appointed Bath as his business representative in Texas. So Bath was Sheikh bin Laden's business representative in Texas, that the father of Osama bin Laden. More about George W.'s denial of knowing Bath, and again, that was obviously a lie. A few months later, however, the release of tax documents and personal financial records forced George W. to admit that Bath had indeed been one of Arbusto Energy's original investors. Bush said that to his knowledge, Bath's investment was from personal funds, and no available evidence existed to determine that the money came from Saudi interests. Numerous questions remain unanswered as to Bath's motives behind his investment in George W.'s first business venture. And in a footnote, U.S. intelligence agencies were concerned that bin Laden might attempt to assassinate George W. or the former president when both men toured the Middle East and met with Arab and Jewish leaders in November of 1998, only 4 months after the embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania. And bear in mind that when Bush invested, when Bath rather invested $50,000 in Arbusto Energy, as written here and reported by Time Magazine reporters Beatty and Gwynn, Time, a very conservative publication, by the way, the Houston businessman, quote, had no substantial money of his own at the time. And as noted by Hadfield, ironically, the money used to underwrite the first business venture of a possible future president of the United States may have been derived at least in part from the family fortune of Saudi terrorist Osama bin Laden. More about the Bath bin Laden Bush connection from a book which was cited in that J.H. Hadfield book, Fortunate Son, a suppressed biography. This is about BCCI. It's called The Outlaw Bank, subtitled A Wild Ride into the Secret Heart of BCCI. This is co-authored by Jonathan Beatty, B-E-A-T-Y, and S.C. Gwynn, G-W-Y-N-N-E. It's copyright 1993 by Ramjack Incorporated, and this was published in the United States by Random House. And the White referred to here is a Bill White, who was a business partner of James R. Bath, and later found himself at loggerheads with Mr. Bath. Quote, and this is Bill White talking here about his former business partner and eventual enemy. You have to understand that I thought, beginning again, you have to understand that they thought I was one of them, unquote, White said earnestly. Again quoting, Bath told me that he was in the CIA. He told me he had been recruited by George Bush himself in 1976 when Bush was director of the agency. That made sense to me, especially in light of what I had seen once we went into business together. Bath and George Jr. were pals and flew together in the same Air National Guard unit, and Bath lived just down the street from the Bush family when George Sr. was living in Houston. He said Bush wanted him involved with the Arabs and to get into the aviation business, unquote. White began pulling documents out of his cases as he talked, quote, That's how Bath, who didn't know anything about the aviation business, became one of the biggest jet aviation dealers in the country within a couple of years. Look, here's a Boeing he's leasing to the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company. That's a multi-million dollar jet. And that's how he became a representative for Sheikh Khalid bin Mahfouz, whose family controls the National Commercial Bank of Saudi Arabia. And I would note that's also how he came to be the Texas business representative for Sheikh bin Laden, the father of Osama bin Laden. Now, in this book, it maintains, Bill White says that Bath told him that he was in the CIA, having been recruited by George Bush Sr. when he was director of the CIA. He then goes into business with George W. Bush, or Jr., as he's sometimes called, and becomes one of the top aviation brokers in the United States, despite the fact that he knew nothing about the aviation business. This is a connection that raises more questions than it answers. Bear in mind that the Wahhabi sect, of which bin Laden is now probably the best-known combatant, has been very active in various parts of the world on behalf of Islamic fundamentalism, including some of the oil-producing regions of the former Soviet Union. And indeed, the U.S. has been quite overt about trying to weaken Russian control of the petroleum-rich Caspian Sea. It also sheds an interesting light on the embassy bombings in August of 1998, when Bill Clinton was facing impeachment, and when his actions in retaliating for those bombings alienated the left wing of his own party from Bill Clinton. I commented at the time that Clinton was essentially damned if he did and damned if he didn't with regard to the embassy bombings. If he had responded in a proper fashion, or what I would consider to be a proper fashion, to launch a long, time-consuming counterintelligence investigation in order to locate the suspects and attempt to bring them to justice, that is a process that would have almost certainly taken years. And yet, just imagine how the talking heads would have reacted if Clinton had responded in that fashion. Bear in mind that not only had American lives been lost and property destroyed, but there were threats of more action to be taken by the terrorist groups. The talking heads would have been saying, well, this is proof that Clinton is too weak and that he's got to resign. I mean, here we have American lives lost, American property threatened, and threats of more. This is a time for decisive presidential action to protect the lives of American citizens and American property, and yet Clinton is just launching an investigation. This is proof that his presidency is too weakened, he can no longer do the job, and would have to step down, blah, 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 blah. So he was damned if he did and damned if he didn't. And also one should bear in mind one of the lessons of the Kennedy assassination, that is to say the John Kennedy assassination, which is that the president is not in control of the intelligence community and ultimately is dependent on them for his view of the world to a certain extent. Bear in mind that Ramzi Youssef, one of the masterminds of the World Trade Center bombing, which I have analyzed in the past as part of a destabilization campaign against the Clinton administration, Ramzi Youssef was a protege of Osama bin Laden, and there are also eyewitness accounts linking Ramzi Youssef with Terry Nichols in the Philippines. Terry Nichols, of course, one of the perpetrators of the Oklahoma City bombing, the alleged mastermind, according to an ATF informant of that bombing. Andreas Strassmeyer, the son of Gunter Strassmeyer, Helmut Kohl's chief of staff, and the architect, that is to say, Gunter Strassmeyer was the architect of German reunification. Andreas Strassmeyer was present at the reunification ceremony, and that would have given him a German government security clearance. Bear in mind also that Ramzi Youssef, a participant in the World Trade Center bombing and an associate of bin Laden, Ramzi Youssef also reputedly tried to kill Bill Clinton when he traveled to the Philippines in 1994. One wonders whether perhaps the Bush, Reagan, Petroleum, Underground Reich faction of our intelligence system was behind some of those activities, either directed against Bill Clinton or working to destabilize his administration. One wonders whether perhaps the petroleum-related sections of our intelligence community, which would certainly embrace the Bush family, is involved in some of the shenanigans in the former Soviet Union. In particular, the accounts that bin Laden has been associated with some of the guerrillas in Chechnya who attacked Dagestan, a key Russian facility with regard to Caspian Sea oil. As mentioned in that Carl Rowan column, George W. Has finally launched his foreign policy edicts and said what he's going to do in terms of foreign policy. Not only would his hard stance against Russia and China initiate a new Cold War and very expensive arms races against those countries, it would also alienate those countries and put them probably in the German trade camp, because Germany would in all likelihood pick up the slack with regard to trade with those two enormous countries. George W. has now finally come out of the starting gate, I guess one could say, with regard to foreign policy. A very interesting note should be taken in that context of who one of his primary foreign policy advisors is. Reading now from the New York Times of Saturday, November 20th of 1999. This is a story by R.W. Apple, Jr., dateline Simi Valley, California, November 19th, and headlined, Bush Questions Aid to Moscow in a policy talk. He's basically, among other things, looking to cut off aid to Moscow, thereby weakening Moscow's attempts at putting the Wahhabi uprising on their southern border to rest, the uprising in Dagestan and Chechnya. Bear in mind that this is actually part of Russia. This is about Bush's foreign policy talk, and in this particular article, again from the New York Times of 11-20-99, story by R.W. Apple, Jr., there is a list of George Bush's foreign security or foreign policy advisors, most of whom had served in past administrations, and many had served with his father. There's a list of the various advisors, and one of them in particular I thought was worth noting. This is Robert Zoellick, Zoellick, of Harvard. This is a German-American, obviously, an American of German extraction. Robert Zoellick, Zoellick, of Harvard, Goldman Sachs, and the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Again, this from the New York Times of 11-20-99, one of George W. Bush's key foreign policy advisors, Robert Zoellick of Harvard, the German Marshall Fund of the United States, and Goldman Sachs. That's one of the top Bush foreign policy advisors. And one should note that he not only worked with Goldman Sachs, the investment house, but also is with not only Harvard University, but the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Now, that's an institution that you will see funding programming on the public broadcasting system. It also is an organization that was crafted in order to basically serve as a PR arm for the key German corporations that had backed Hitler. And it is, of course, thereby inevitably linked to the deadly Bormann Flight Capital organization about which I have spoken so often. We're going to turn again to the definitive text on the Borman Organization, authored by Paul Manning, part of the CBS News team that covered World War II, along with Edward R. Murrow, a close colleague. Manning broadcast the surrenders of both Japan and Germany to the American people on the CBS radio network, and in order to cover the air war in Europe, trained as a waist gunner on a B-17. In order to cover the air war in Japan, he became a nose gunner on a B-29 because the aircraft could not carry journalists on air raids into enemy territory in case they got hit and had to limp back to base. They couldn't carry extra weight. So in order to cover those raids, a journalist had to become a combatant. Paul Manning then became a very heroic journalist in the post-war period as well, having provided us with the definitive text on the Borman Flight Capital Organization. Now, of the creation of the German Marshall Fund of the United States, its role as a PR institution for corporate Germany, and its connections to Borman and the Borman Organization, Paul Manning writes as follows, bearing in mind that Robert Zelick of Harvard University and Goldman Sachs is also of the German, works for the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Turning to Martin Borman, Nazi in Exile, published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart, copyright 1981, we read, by the 1970s, the West Germans had concluded that influencing U.S. public opinion is better accomplished with a skillful touch than with a meat cleaver, which had characterized their efforts during the two world wars. An example of such skill was the staged news event of June 5, 1972, when Willy Brandt announced at Harvard University that the Federal Republic of Germany would donate 150 million marks, or $47 million, to establish a foundation in the honor of the Marshall Plan, a statesmanlike approach to the recovery of former enemies and to the recovery generally of Western Europe. Brandt stated that the money would arrive in equal installments for the next 15 years for the establishment and operation in the United States of an independent, American-run educational foundation specializing in solutions to European problems to be known as the, quote, German Marshall Fund of the United States, unquote, a memorial to the Marshall Plan, unquote. The overriding function of this German George C. Marshall Research Foundation is public relations to cosmetize the German industrialists and bankers whose corporations had worked so successfully for the Third Reich. This sentence again, because it defines what the German Marshall Fund is. The overriding function of this German George C. Marshall Research Foundation is public relations to cosmetize the German industrialists and bankers whose corporations had worked so successfully for the Third Reich. In October of 1978, the Marshall Foundation was utilized as a platform for Dr. Hermann J. Abs, now honorary president of Deutsche Bank AG, as he addressed a meeting of businessmen and bankers and members of the Foreign Policy Association in New York City on, quote, the problems and prospects of German-American economic cooperation, unquote. This luncheon meeting was chaired by his old friend, John J. McCloy, Wall Street banker and lawyer, who had worked closely with Dr. Abs when McCloy served as U.S. High Commissioner for Germany during those post-war Reconstruction years. At that time, Hermann Abs, as chief executive of Deutsche Bank, was also directing the spending of America's Marshall Plan money in West Germany as the chairman of the Reconstruction Loan Corporation of the Federal Republic of Germany. With them on the dais were Henry H. Fowler, Wall Street investment banker and former U.S. Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Cabot Lodge, former U.S. ambassador to the Federal Republic of Germany, George C. McGee, another former American ambassador to Germany, also a trustee of the Marshall Foundation, and a member of various private and government advisory groups. These, along with the others on the dais and in the audience, represent firms and banks that are among the most prestigious in the United States and throughout the world. All benefited from the rebirth and rebounding prosperity of the new Federal Republic of Germany. Knowingly or not, these figures and their corporations are indebted to the man who was not there, the financial and administrative genius who set the foundation for the post-war recovery of West Germany, Martin Borman. So interesting that a representative of this organization, Robert Zelick, is one of George W.'s top foreign policy advisors. What we're going to do next is to review a short section of For the Record segment 177 about the Fortunate Son biography that I excerpted earlier. This was suppressed. This excerpt comes from For the Record segment 177. With regard to the Bormann Group, that it controls the major German corporations, and they operate in concert as part of an organized political and military strategy. In FTR's 122 and 123, I described the von Holtzbrinck firm. Among the many English-language publishing outfits that they control is St. Martin's, and that has recently come into public view with regard to a biography of George W. Bush, the odds-on favorite to get the Republican nomination, which alleged an arrest for cocaine use in 1972. It then turned out that the author, one J.H. Hatfield, had a criminal record, and had apparently attempted to kill a boss with a car bomb, at least according to official reportage. The New York Times of Wednesday, October 27th of 1999, described this book and described the editor of the editor-in-chief, the head of St. Martin's, resigning over this particular biography. I've spoken in the past about the Bush family's connections to the Underground Reich, the progenitors of George Herbert Walker and George W. Bush had companies that were deeply involved with the Third Reich, and George Herbert Walker Bush is very close to the Nazi branch of the Republican Party, the Republican Ethnic Outreach Section. It's interesting to watch this particular biography. It'll be interesting to see if it winds up putting the whammy on the George W. cocaine story, because, as some have noted, journalists are kind of like blackbirds. They light together on a wire and they all fly away together. It'll be interesting to see if this highly secretive biography keeps people away from the George W. cocaine story and then contributes to his election. We've spoken about allegations that George W. was involved in a DEA sting, picking up kilos of cocaine in the past in some of our conversations with Mike Rupert. This from the New York Times of 10/27/99 is an article by Doreen Carvajal, C-A-R-V-A-J-A-L, entitled "Editor Quits Amid Turmoil Surrounding Book on Bush." The editor-in-chief of St. Martin's Press abruptly resigned from the company yesterday in another sign of continuing turmoil at the New York Publishing House after its cancellation of a biography of Governor George W. Bush of Texas by an author with a criminal record. Skipping down, former and current employees at St. Martin said it was entirely plausible that the editor-in-chief had not been informed early in the process about the book, which was considered so secret at the company that St. Martin's sales representatives referred to the title by the code MJ. The Bush biography was acquired, edited, and published by Mr. Dunn's imprint, a separate line of books with its own logo that is distinct from the St. Martin's brand. And Mr. Wallace, Robert Wallace, claims that he never knew about this particular book. Skipping down, St. Martin's Press is part of Verlagsgruppe George von Holtzbrinck, a German media conglomerate based in Stuttgart. And this indicates the extent to which the publishers, among other media corporations, influence public opinion. And again, with connections of the Bush family to what I've termed the Underground Reich, it'll be interesting to see whether this spurious biography keeps journalists away from the allegations of cocaine purchase on camera by George W. Bush, thereby contributing to his election. That'll be an interesting, it's what I call food for thought and grounds for further research. And as I've asked on the weekly show that I do on my home base station, is George W. the Bormann candidate? And again, food for thought, grounds for further research. We're going to conclude the broadcast on a somewhat light note. There was a very witty letter to the editor written to the New York Times about George W.'s foreign policy address. This from the New York Times of 11/23/99. A Lisa DiCaprio wrote as follows to the editor. You note, front page, November 20th, the general concern about George W. Bush's lack of foreign policy experience and knowledge, but conclude that his, quote, confident performance, unquote, in a foreign policy speech given at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library, again quoting, put such fears to the rest for the moment, unquote. In fact, the speech proved only that Mr. Bush can read well from a script prepared for him by a group of advisors drawn from his father's presidency. We learn that Mr. Bush, quote, laced his address with quotes from Pericles, among others, unquote. Does anyone really believe that Mr. Bush, who recently referred to Greeks as Grecians, is now reading Pericles? Indeed. That concludes this broadcast. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.